business requiring considerable chic on the part of its employees. The journey back to town was not a slow and pleasant revolving of sunlit thoughts. The sun had gone, and a grey mist blotted out the lines of the country. It looked flat, dreary, and unwholesome in the wan evening. Here and there a sheet of water gleamed balefully from among the poplars with the flat, unreflecting surface of pewter. Grant devoted himself to the papers, and when he had exhausted them, watched the grey, formless evening flying past, and let his mind play with the problem of the dead man's occupation. There were three other men in the compartment, and their voluble and occasional vociferous pronouncements on the subject of casings, whatever they might be, distracted and annoyed him unreasonably. A tangle of signal lights hung, isolated and unrelated in their ruby and emerald across the fading daylight, restored his good humour a little. They were a wonder and a revelation, these lights. It was incredible that anything so fairy had its invisible support in stout standards and crossbars and its being in a dynamo. But he was glad when the long roar and rattle over the points proclaimed the end of the journey, and the more robust lights of London hung above him. As he turned into the yard, he had a queer feeling that the thing he had set out to find was waiting for him here. His hunch had not played him false. That scrap of information that would be the key to the whole of the dead man's story was about to be put into his hand. His steps quickened unconsciously. He could hardly wait. Never had lifts seemed so slow or passages so long. And after all, there was nothing. Nothing but the written report which Williams, who had gone to tea, had left for him when he should come in, a more detailed recapitulation of what he had already heard over the telephone. But at the exact moment that Inspector Grant had turned into the yard, a queer thing had happened to Danny Miller. He had been seated sideways in an easy chair in an upper room of the house in Pimlico, his neat feet in their exquisite shoes dangling idly from the upholstered arm, and a cigarette in a 6-inch holder projecting at an aggressive angle from his thin mouth. Standing in the middle of the floor was his Jane. She was engaged in trying on a series of evening frocks, which she wrested from their cardboard shelves as one thumbs peas from a pod. Slowly she turned her beautiful body so that the light caught the beaded surface of the fragile stuff and accentuated the long lines of her figure. "That's a nice one, isn't it?" she said, her eyes seeking Danny's in the mirror. But even as she looked, she saw the eyes, focused on the middle of her back, widen to a wild stare. She swung round. "What's the matter?" she asked. But Danny apparently did not hear her. The focus of his eyes did not alter. Suddenly he snatched the cigarette holder from his mouth, pitched the cigarette into the fireplace, and sprang to his feet with wild gropings about him. "My hat," he said. "Where's my hat? Where the hell's my hat?"
"It's on the chair behind you," she said, amazed. "What's biting you?"
Danny snatched the hat and fled out of the room as if all the fiends in the lower regions were on his heels. She heard him pitch himself down the stairs, and then the front door closed with a bang. She was still standing with startled eyes on the door when she heard him coming back. Up the stairs he came, three at a time, as lightly as a cat, and burst into her presence.
"Gimme tuppence," he said. "I haven't got tuppence."
Mechanically, she reached out for the very expensive and rather beautiful handbag that had been one of his presents to her, and produced 2 pennies.
"I didn't know you were that broke,"
she said, in an effort to goad him into explanation.
"What do you want them for?"
"You go to blazes," he snapped, and disappeared again. He arrived at the nearest call-box, slightly breathless, but exceedingly pleased with himself, and without condescending to anything so mundane as a consultation with the telephone directory, demanded to be connected with Scotland Yard. During the subsequent delay, he executed a neat shuffle on the floor of the call box as a means of expressing at once his impatience and his triumph. At last, there was Grant's voice at the end of the wire.
"I say, Inspector, this is Miller speaking. I've just remembered where I saw that guy you were talking about. Remember?" "Well, I travelled in a race train to Leicester with him. End of January, I think it was." "Sure? I remember as if it was yesterday. We talked racing and he seemed to know quite a lot about it. But I never saw him before or since." "Eh? No, I didn't see any bookmaking things." "Don't mention it. I'm pleased to death to be able to help. I told you my brain didn't go back on me for long."
Danny quitted the box and set out, a little more soberly this time, to smooth down an outraged and abandoned female in a beaded evening frock, and Grant hung up his receiver and expelled a long breath. A race train! The thing had all the fittingness of truth. What a fool he had been! What a double-dyed infernal fool! Not to have thought of that! Not to have remembered that, though Nottingham to two-thirds of Britain may mean lace, to the other third it means racing. And, of course, racing explained the man. His clothes, his visit to Nottingham, his predilection for musical comedy, even, perhaps, the gang. He sent out for a racing up-to-date. Yes, there had been a jumping meeting at Colwick Park on the 2nd of February and one in Leicester at the end of January. That checked Danny's statement. Danny had provided the key. Information like that, Grant thought bitterly, would come on a Saturday evening when bookmakers were as if they had not been, as far as their offices were concerned. And as for tomorrow, no bookmaker was at home on a Sunday. The very thought of a whole day without travelling scattered them over the length and breadth of England in their cars as quicksilver scatters when spilt. Both bank and bookmaking investigations would be hindered by the intervention of the weekend. Grant left word of his whereabouts and repaired to Laurence. On Monday there would be more hack work, a round of the offices with the tie and revolver, the revolver that no one so far had claimed to have seen. But perhaps before then, the banknotes would have provided a clue that would speed things up and obviate the laborious method of elimination. Meantime, he would have an early dinner and think things over. Chapter 6. The Dago. The green and gold room was half empty as he made his way to a corner, and Marcel lingered to talk. Things marched with the inspector, it seemed. Ah, but Inspector Grant was a marvel, to have built a whole man out of a little dagger. The press, with the exception of the early morning editions, had blazoned the wanted man's description all over Britain. It was a thing, à faire peur. If he, Marcel, was to bring him a fish-fork with the entree, it might be made to prove that he had a corn on the left little toe. Grant disclaimed any such Holmesian qualities. The usual explanation advanced for such little mistakes is that the guilty one is in love. "Oh, non, alors," laughed Marcel. "I defy even Inspector Grant to find me guilty of that." "Oh, are you a misanthrope?" asked Grant. No, Marcel loved his kind, but his wife was an exacting woman. Grant should know. "I think I made the acquaintance of a pantry boy of yours the other day," Grant said. "Lagarde, was it?" "Ah, Raoul, a good boy, very, and beautiful too, huh? Such a profile and such eyes. They had wanted him for the cinema, but Raoul would have none of it. He was going to be maître d'hôtel Raoul, and if Marcel was any judge, he would be." A new arrival took the table opposite, and Marcel, the geniality gone from his face like snowflakes on a wet pavement, went to listen to his needs with that mixture of tolerant superciliousness and godlike abstraction which he used to all but his five favourites. Grant made a leisurely meal, but even after lingering over coffee it was still early when he found himself in the street. The Strand was brilliant as day and crowded, the ebb of the late homegoers meeting the current of the early pleasure-seekers and causing a fret that filled both footpath and roadway. Slowly he walked up the gaudy pavement towards Charing Cross, in and out of the changing light from the shop windows, rose light, gold light, diamond light, shoe shop, clothes shop, jewellers. Presently, in the wider pavement before the old bottleneck, the crowd thinned out and men and women became individual beings instead of the corpuscles of a mob. The man who had been walking several yards in front of Grant turned round as if to see the number of an oncoming bus. His glance fell on Grant, and in the bright diamond light from the window his placid face became suddenly a mask of horror. Without a second's hesitation or a look to right or left, he plunged headlong into the traffic in front of the charging bus. Grant was held up by the bus as it thundered past, but before the end of it had swung by, he was off the pavement and into the maelstrom after the man. In that crowded moment, when his eyes were more for a figure in flight than for the dangers that threatened himself, he thought distinctly, "Won't it be awful to die under a bus in the Strand after dodging the Bosch for 4 years?" A yell in his ear, and he hovered in flight sufficiently to let a taxi scrape past him by inches, with a blasphemous driver howling vituperation at him. He dodged a yellow sports car, saw a whirring black thing at his left elbow, which he recognised as the front wheel of a bus, leaped back, was charged on his right by another taxi, and sprang behind the bus as it passed, and a yard in front of the following one, to safety, on the far pavement. A quick glance to right and left. There was his man, walking composedly towards Bedford Street. He had evidently not expected such a quick decision on the inspector's part. Grant metaphorically vowed a candle to the saint that had taken him safely across the street, and fell to the casual stroll that kept him at the right distance from his quarry. "Now if he looks round before Bedford Street," he thought, "I'll know I wasn't mistaken, that it really was the sight of me and not a sudden thought that scared him." But he did not need another glance at the man to verify his impression of high cheekbones, thin dark face, and jutting chin. And he knew as surely as if he saw it that on the man's left forefinger or thumb was a recent scar. A second later the man looked back, not with that momentary absent-minded glance that one gives, not knowing why, but with that two-second turn of the head which means a deliberate scrutiny. And a second after, he had vanished up Bedford Street. And then Grant sprinted. Vividly he could see in his mind that thin figure flying up the dark and deserted street with none to say him nay. As he turned the corner and pulled up, he could see no sign of his quarry. Now, not even a burly could have been out of sight in the time if he had taken a straight course, so Grant, expecting a bluff, walked briskly up the right-hand side of the street, his eye wary at each recess. As nothing materialized, he grew anxious. A consciousness of being fooled grew within him. He stopped and looked back, and as he did so, down at the Strand end, a figure moved from a doorway on the other side of the street and fled back to the crowded thoroughfare it had left. In 30 seconds, Grant had gained the Strand again, but the man was gone. Buses came and went, taxis floated by, shops were open all up and down the street. The choice of a means of escape was not wanting. Grant cursed, and even as he cursed, he thought, "Well, he fooled me very neatly, but I expect he's cursing harder than I am for being such a fool as to show that he knew me." That was a very bad break, and for the first time he felt pleased with the press who had made so free with his features in their desire to educate the public. He patrolled the street for a while, casting exploratory but unoptimistic glances into the shops as he passed. Then he withdrew into the shadow of a doorway, where he remained for some time, hoping against hope that the man had gone to ground instead of making a break for it, and would reappear when he thought the coast was clear. The only result of that was that an inquisitive policeman who had watched him for some time from across the street wanted to know what he was waiting for. Grant came out into the light and explained the circumstances to the apologetic officer, and, deciding that his man had bolted, went to telephone to the yard. His first impulse, when the man had tricked him and run for it, had been to throw a squad into the Strand, but the sight of the swift traffic and the knowledge that by the time anyone arrived from the embankment, even in a fast car, the wanted man might be well on the way to Golders Green or Camberwell or Elstree, had deterred him. It was hardly an occasion for turning out the force. As he went slowly up to Trafalgar Square, after the business of telephoning, his spirits lightened. For the last hour he had been disgusted with himself to an extent that beggared his vocabulary. He had had the Dago within 6 yards of him, and he had let him slip through his fingers. Now the lighter side of the situation was becoming apparent. He had made a backward slip, certainly, but even at the end of the slip he was further on, much further on, than when he had started. He knew for a certainty that the Dago was in London. That was a tremendous advance. Until his description had been furnished to the police the previous night, there had been nothing to prevent the murderer from leaving London at any moment. They would have had to consider reports from all over Britain, and Grant had bitter experience of such reports of wanted men. And perhaps the Continent, if it had not been for that chance meeting in the Strand, and the man's lack of self-control in a delirious moment. Now they knew he was in London, and could concentrate their forces. He might leave it by road, but he could not by any other method, and Grant had seen to it that he would have difficulty in hiring a car from any recognised garage. That merely made things difficult for him. It did not prevent him from going if he wanted to, but it made his exit considerably slower. It was strange in the circumstances that he had stayed at all when the way was clear, but Grant knew the Londoner's mulish habit of clinging to the town he knows, and the Dago's rat-like preference for the sewers rather than the open. Both would be more likely to hide than to run. And of course the wanted man, though his description had not been broadcast, had no guarantee that the police were not in possession of it. It would have required more courage or more foolhardihood than most men possess to face a ticket collector or a boat official in these circumstances. So the man had stuck to the town. From now on he would be at the mercy of a continual patrol of the flying squad, and his chances of slipping through their fingers again were very small. Moreover, Grant had seen him. That was another enormous advance. They could never meet again, even in the distance, without Grant recognizing him. The Dago in London, the dead man's friend in London, presumably, the Dago recognizable, the friend about to be traced by his banknotes. Things, as Marcel had remarked, were marching. At the bottom of St. Martin's Lane, Grant remembered that this was the last night of Didn't You Know? He would drop in there for a little and then go back to the yard. His thoughts worked much better without goading, and the quiet of the room at the yard was a silent goad that maddened him. His thoughts would never work to order. There was more likelihood of a revelation being vouchsafed him in the middle of the teeming streets, in the seething mob that somewhere held the Dago, than in the imposing isolation of his room. The play had been in progress for about 20 minutes when Grant, after a chat with the manager, found 6 square inches of standing room at the back of the dress circle. It was a magnificent sight, looked at from the darkness of so remote a vantage. The theatre, never a very accommodating one, was packed from floor to ceiling, its rosy dimness filled with the electric quality that is only found when every man of an audience is an enthusiast. And they were all enthusiasts, that last night crowd, devotees saying farewell to the object of their adoration. Adulation, camaraderie, and regret filled the house and made the gathering completely un-British in its abandon to the emotion of the moment. Now and then, when Gollum left out an old gag, someone would call a correction.
"Give us all of it, Golly," they cried. "Give us all of it."
And Golly gave them all he had. Ray Markable trailed her loveliness over a nearly empty stage with that half-reluctant lightness of a leaf in the wind. She was always, when she danced, a mere fraction of a beat behind the music, so that it seemed as if, instead of being an accompaniment, the music was the motive power, as if it was the music that lifted and spun and whirled her, floated her sideways, and relinquished her gently as it died. Again and again at their vociferous demands, the music lifted her into motion, held her laughing and sparkling and quivering like a crystal ball held poised on a jet of water, and dropped her in a quick descending run to a fast-breathing stillness broken by the crash of the applause. They would not let her go, and when at last someone held her forcibly in the wings and an effort was made to get on with the story, there was unconcealed impatience. No one wanted a plot tonight. No one had ever wanted one. Quite a large number of the most enthusiastic habitués were unaware that there was such a thing, and few, if any, would have been able to give a lucid account of it. And tonight, to insist on wasting time with such irrelevance was folly. The entrance of the most perfect chorus in Britain soothed them slightly. The 14 Woffington girls were famous in 2 continents, and their studies in synchronized motion gave one the same feeling of complete satisfaction, the satisfaction that never becomes satiety, that one has on beholding the guards in motion. Not a head turned too much, not a toe was out of alignment. No kick was higher than its neighbor, no flop was quicker than another. When the last of the 14 flicked her black and orange columbine skirt in a little defiant motion as she disappeared behind the flats, the audience had almost forgotten Ray. Almost, but not quite. Ray and Gollum possessed the house. It was their night, theirs and the public's. And presently, the impatience with anything that was not Ray or Gollum became too marked to be ignored. The evening was one long crescendo of excitement that was rapidly reaching hysteria point. Grant watched, half-pityingly, the wry smile with which the leading man acknowledged the conventional plaudits accorded to his sentimental solo. That solo was sung by languishing tenors all over Britain, whistled by every errand boy, played with lowered lights by every dance orchestra. He had obviously expected it to be encored at least 3 times, but beyond humming the last chorus with him, they had shown no marked appreciation of it. Something had gone wrong. They couldn't even see him. With as good a grace as he could muster, he took his place as background to Ray Markable, danced with her, sang with her, acted with her. And Grant suddenly caught himself wondering if his eclipse were merely the accident of Ray Markable's vivid personality, or if she had used that personality deliberately to keep the limelight where she happened to be. Grant had no illusions about the theatre or about the professional generosity of leading ladies. Theatrical stars were easily moved to tears and a lavish expenditure over a hard luck story, but their good nature withered at the fount when confronted with a successful rival. Ray Markable had a reputation for all-round generosity and sweet reasonableness. But then her press agent was wily beyond the average of that wily race. Grant himself had read Pars about her, which he had not recognized as an agent's work until his eye had gone on to the next item of interest. He had that supreme quality, her press agent, of making the advertised one's presence in the story entirely and convincingly incidental to the main theme. And then there was the suspicious fact that she had had 3 leading men in the 2 years, whereas the rest of the cast had stayed the same. Could her friendly air, her modesty, her—there was no other word for it—her ladylikeness be camouflage? Was London's fragile darling hard as nails underneath? He visualized her as he had met her, off, unassuming, intelligent, eminently reasonable. No parade of temperament or idiosyncrasy. A charming girl with her head screwed on the right way. It was hardly credible. He had known among crooks many women of the fluffy type who had no softer feelings whatever in their make-up. But Ray Markable's was a sweetness that had no fluff about it, a sweetness that he could have sworn was genuine. He watched her closely now, trying to disprove for his own satisfaction. He had liked her enormously, that suggestion which his mind had thrown up involuntarily. But to his dismay he found his suspicions, now that they were acknowledged and made the subject of investigation, being slowly confirmed. She was keeping the man out of it. When he looked for indications, they were all there, but they were done with a subtlety such as Grant had never witnessed before. There was nothing so crude as trying to share or divert his applause, or even cutting his applause short by an intrusion of her own. All these would have been recognizable for what they were, and therefore, from her point of view, not permissible. It occurred to him that she was not only too subtle to use such a method, but too potent to need to. She had only to use her glowing personality with unscrupulousness, and rivals faded out as stars before the sun. Only with Gollan she was powerless. He was a sun as potent, if not more so, than herself, and so she suffered him. But with her leading man, good-looking, amiable, and a very fine singer, she had no difficulty. They had said, he remembered now, that it was impossible to find a leading man good enough for her. That was why. He did not doubt it now. There was something uncanny about the clearness with which he suddenly read her mind, untouched by the glamour that surrounded him. Only he and she and all that intoxicated crowd were aloof, were poised above emotion and looking on. He watched her play with that unhappy wretch as coldly and deliberately as he would have played a trout in the test. Smiling and sweet, she took what would have been a triumph from his hands and tacked it on to her own dazzling outfit. And no one noticed that the triumph had gone astray. If they thought at all, they thought that the leading man was not up to the mark tonight. But, of course, it was difficult to get one good enough for her. And after having absorbed his worth, she would, at the end of a turn, with a Machiavellian acuteness, drag him forward by the hand to share the applause, so that everyone in the building thought, well, he didn't deserve much of it. And his inferiority was accentuated and remembered. Oh, yes, it was subtle. This play within a play became for Grant the absorbing entertainment of the evening. He was seeing the real Ray Markable, and the sight was incredibly strange. So rapt was he that the final curtain found him still at the back of the circle, deafened by the cheers and feeling strangely cold. Again and again, and yet again, the curtain rose on the glittering stage, and the stream of presents and flowers began to flow over the footlights. Then the speeches came. First Gollan, clutching a large square bottle of whiskey and trying to be funny, but not succeeding, because his voice would not stay steady. Grant guessed that in his mind was a picture of the heartbreaking years of squalid rooms in squalid towns, twice nightly performances, and the awful ever-present fear of the bird. Gollan had sung long for his supper. It was no wonder that the feast choked him. Then the producer. Then Ray Markable.
"Ladies and gentlemen," she said in her clear, slow voice, 2 years ago, when none of you knew me, you were kind to me. You overwhelmed me then. Tonight you have overwhelmed me again. I can only say thank you.
Very neat, thought Grant, as they cheered her to the echo. Quite in the part, and he turned away. He knew what was coming. Speeches by everyone, down to the call boy, and he had heard enough. He went down through the crimson and buff vestibule and out into the night with a queer constriction in his chest. If he had not, in his 35 years, cast overboard all such impedimenta as illusion, one would have said that he was disillusioned. He had quite liked Ray Markable. Chapter 7. Things Move.
"It's not a Christian knife at all," said Mrs. Field, as she put the inevitable bacon and eggs in front of him.
Mrs. Field had tried to cure Grant of the bacon and eggs habit by providing wonderful breakfasts with recipes culled from her daily paper, and kidneys and other favours wrested from Mr. Tompkins at the threat of withdrawing her custom, but Grant had defeated her, as he defeated most people in time. He still had bacon and eggs Saturday, Sunday, Monday. It was now 8 o'clock on Sunday morning, which was the fact that had called forth Mrs. Field's remark. Unchristian, in Mrs. Field's vocabulary, meant not any lack of conformity, but an absence of comfort and respectability. The fact that he was having breakfast before 8 on a Sunday morning shocked her infinitely more than the fact that his day was to be spent in the most mundane of work. She grieved over him.
"It's a wonder to me that the King doesn't give you inspector's decorations oftener than he does. What other man in London is having breakfast at this hour when he needn't?"
"In that case, I think inspector's landladies should be included in the decoration. Mrs. Field, O.B.E., for being an inspector's landlady."
"Oh, the honour's enough for me without the decoration," she said.
"I'd like to think of a good rejoinder to that, but I never could say graceful things at breakfast. It takes a woman to be witty at 8 in the morning.
"You'd be surprised, really, at the standing it gives me, you being an inspector at Scotland Yard."
"Does it really?"
"It does. But don't you be afraid. I keep my mouth shut. Nothing ever comes out through me. There's lots would like to know what the inspector thought or who came to see the inspector, but I just sit and let them hint. You don't have to see a hint unless you like."
"It is very noble of you, Mrs. Field, to achieve a reputation for obtuseness for my sake." Mrs. Field blinked and recovered herself.
"It's my duty, if it wasn't my pleasure," she said, and made a graceful exit.
As he was going away after breakfast, she surveyed the untouched toast sorrowfully.
"Well, see that you have a good meal in the middle of the day. You can't think to any advantage on an empty stomach."
"But you can't run to any advantage on a full one."
"You'll never have to run very far after anyone in London. There's always someone to head them off."
Grant was smiling to himself as he went down the sunny road to the bus stop at this simplification of the work of the CID. But there was no heading off the people who claimed to have seen the wanted man. Nearly half London appeared to have set eyes on him, his back as often as not, and the number of cut hands that required investigation would have been incredible to anyone who has not witnessed a manhunt from the inside. Patiently, Grant sifted the reports through the long, bright morning, sitting at his desk and sending his lieutenants out here and there as a general arranges his forces on a battlefield. The provincial clues he ignored, with the exception of 2, which were too good to be passed over. There was always the odd chance that the man in the Strand had not been the Dago. 2 men were sent to investigate these, one to Cornwall and one to York. All day long the telephone at his elbow buzzed, and all day long messages of failure came over it. Some of the men they had been sent out to observe had not, in the detective's opinion, the remotest resemblance to the wanted man. This valuable information was obtained often enough at the cost of a long afternoon's vigil behind the Nottingham lace curtains of a suburban villa waiting for the man three houses down to pass within examining distance. One suspect proved to be a nobleman, well known to the public as a polo player. The officer who tracked him down saw that he had aroused the Earl's curiosity. The noble lord had been run to earth in a garage where he was collecting his car preparatory to having a little flip of 300 or 400 miles as a slight Sunday diversion, and confessed what his business was. "I thought you were tailing me," said the peer of the realm, "and as my conscience is particularly good at the moment, I wondered what you were up to. I have been accused of taking many things in my short time, but never of looking like a murderer before. Good luck to you, by all means." "Thank you, sir. Same to you. I hope your conscience will be as clear when you come back." And the Earl, who had more convictions for exceeding the speed limit than anyone else in England, had grinned appreciatively. Truly it was the men who went out who found work light that Sunday, and it was Grant, sitting pulling strings with mechanical competence, who found it tedious. Barker came in the afternoon, but had no suggestion to make which might expedite matters. They could afford to ignore nothing. The least helpful of the clues had to be investigated in the relentless process of elimination. It was spade work, and most unchristian, in the field sense. Grant looked enviously from his window, through the bright mist that hung over the river at the Surrey side, lit now by the westering sun. How good it would be to be in Hampshire today! He could see the woods on Danebury in their first green, and a little later in the evening, when the sun went, the test would be just right for Fly. It was late when Grant got home, but he had not left an avenue of exploration untrodden. With the coming of evening, the spate of reported appearances had gradually diminished and died away. But as he ate his supper, to Mrs. Field a meal was a necessary concomitant to a homecoming, he was wearily conscious of the telephone by the fireplace. He went to bed and dreamed that Ray Markable called him by telephone and said, "You'll never find him. Never, never." She kept repeating the phrase, unheeding of his pleas for information and help, and he wished that the exchange girl would say, "Time up," and release him. But before that relief had come, the telephone had turned into a fishing rod without exciting any surprise on his part, and he was using it, not as a fishing rod, but as a whip to encourage the four in hand, which he was driving down a street in Nottingham. At the end of the street was a marsh, and in front of the marsh, and exactly in the middle of the street, stood the waitress from the hotel. He tried to call out to her as the horses advanced, but his voice died in his throat. Instead, the waitress grew bigger and bigger, until she filled the whole street. As the horses were about to charge into her, she had grown so that she towered over Grant and overwhelmed him, the horses, the street, and everything. He had that sense of inevitability which attends the moment of a catastrophe. "It's come," he thought, and woke to thankful consciousness of a safe pillow and a reasonable world where there was motive before action. "Damn that cheese souffle," he thought, and turning on his back, surveyed the dark ceiling and let his now wide-awake brain go its own way. Why had the man hidden his identity? Was it perhaps mere accident? Nothing but the tailor's name had been obliterated from his clothes, and the maker's name had been left on the tie. Surely a most obvious place if one had been deliberately eliminating identification marks. But if it were a mere accident that eliminated the tailor's name, how account for the scantiness of the man's belongings? Small change, a handkerchief and a revolver, not even a watch. It spoke loudly of intended suicide. Perhaps the man was broke. He didn't look it, but that was no criterion. Grant had known many paupers who looked like millionaires, and beggars with large bank balances. Had the man at the end of his resources decided to end it rather than sink slowly into the gutter? Had the visit to the theatre with his last few shillings been merely a snapping of fingers in the face of the gods who had defeated him? Was it merely the final irony that the dagger had anticipated his own revolver by an hour or two? But if he were broke, why had he not gone to the friend for money, the friend who was so free with his banknotes? Or had he? And the friend had refused it. Was it conscience, after all, that had prompted that anonymous £25? If he decided to accept the presence of the revolver and the absence of clues as evidence of intended suicide, then the murder resolved itself into the outcome of a quarrel, probably between two members of a race gang. Perhaps the Dago had shared in the dead man's downfall and had held the dead man responsible. That was the most reasonable explanation, and it fitted all the circumstances. The man was interested in racing, probably a bookmaker. He was found without watch or money and evidently prepared for suicide. The Dago was heard to demand something, which the dead man either could not or would not give, and the Dago had stabbed him. The friend who had refused him help in life, probably tired of pulling him out of tight places, had been seized with such a fit of remorse on learning of the man's end that he had provided lavishly, if anonymously, for his burial. Pure theory, but it fitted. Almost. There was one corner where no amount of insinuation would make it fit. It did not explain why no one had come forward to claim the dead man. If the affair was merely a quarrel between two men, intimidation was washed out as a theory for the silence of his friends. It was not credible that the Dago had them all in such a state of subjection that not one of them risked even that usual method of the craven and the circumspect, the anonymous communication. It was a curious and almost unique situation. Never in all Grant's experience had a murderer been on the point of being captured before the identity of his victim had been established. A light rain fell across the window pane with stealthy fingers. The end of the good weather, thought Grant. A silence followed, dark and absolute. It was as if an advance guard, a scout, had spied out the land and gone away to report. There was the long, far-away sigh of the wind that had been asleep for days. Then the first blast of the fighting battalions of the rain struck the window in a wild rattle. The wind tore and raved behind them, hounding them to suicidal deeds of valour. And presently the drip, drip from the roof began a constant, gentle monotone beneath the wild symphony, intimate and soothing as the tick of a clock. Grant's eyes closed to it, and before the squall had retreated, muttering into the distance, he was asleep. But in the morning, a grey morning veiled in dispirited drizzle, the theory still looked watertight, with judicious plugging at the weak spot, and it was not until, hard on the track of the dead man's friend, he was interviewing the manager of the Adelphi branch of the Westminster Bank, that he found his nicely made house of cards pattering round his ears. The manager was a quiet grey man, whose unluminous skin had somehow taken on the appearance of a banknote. His manner, however, was more like that of a general practitioner than a financial adviser. Grant found himself momentarily expecting to feel Mr. Dawson's dry fingertips on his wrist. But Mr. Dawson, this morning, was a mixture of mercury and juggernaut. This was his report. The five notes in which the inspector was interested had all of them been paid over the counter on the third of the month as part of a payment of £223.10. The money had been drawn by a client of theirs who had a running account in the bank. His name was Albert Sorrell, and he ran a small bookmaker's business in Minley Street. The sum drawn represented the whole of the money deposited with them, except a pound, which had been left, presumably, with the intention of keeping the account open. Good, thought Grant. The friend is a bookmaker, too. Had Mr. Dawson known Mr. Sorrell by sight? He asked. No, not very well, but his cashier would be able to tell the inspector all about him, and he summoned the cashier. This is Inspector Grant from Scotland Yard. He wants a description of Mr. Albert Sorrell, and I have told him that you will provide him with one. The cashier provided a very telling one. With a minuteness that defeated any hope of a mistake, he described the dead man. When he had finished, Grant sat thinking at top speed. What did it mean? Had the dead man owed the money to the friend, and had the friend taken all he possessed, and afterwards been seized with a too tardy charity? Was that how the notes had come into the friend's possession? On the third, too, that was 10 days before the murder. Did Sorrell draw the money himself? He asked. No, the cashier said, the check had been presented by a stranger. Yes, he remembered him. He was very dark, thin, medium height, or a little under, with high cheekbones. Foreign-looking a little. The Dago! Grant was seized with a mixture of exhilaration and breathlessness, rather as Alice must have felt during her express journey with the Red Queen. Things marched, but at what a bat! He asked to see the check, and it was produced. You don't think that this is a forgery? Such a thought had not occurred to them. Both the amount and the signature had been made out in Mr. Sorrell's handwriting, and that was unusual in an attempt at forgery. They brought out other checks of the dead man's and exhibited them. They refused to entertain the thought that the check was not genuine. "If it is a forgery," Mr. Dawson said, "it is incredibly good. Even if it were proved a forgery, I should have difficulty in believing it. I think you may take it that it is a genuine check." And the Dago had drawn it. The Dago had had all Sorrell's deposit with the exception of 20 shillings. And 10 days later he had stuck Sorrell in the back. Well, if it proved nothing else, it proved the existence of a relationship between the two men which would be useful when it came to evidence in a court of law. "Have you the numbers of the rest of the notes handed over in the money to Sorrell?" They had, and Grant took a list of them. Then he inquired what Sorrell's address was, and was told that they had no home address, but that his office was at 32 Minley Street, off the Charing Cross Road. As Grant walked up to Minley Street from the Strand, he began to digest the news. The Dago had drawn the money with a cheque made payable to Sorrell and endorsed by Sorrell. Theft seemed to be ruled out by the fact that Sorrell had made no fuss in the 10 days intervening between the paying out of the money and his death. Therefore, the cheque had been given to the Dago by Sorrell himself. Why had it not been made payable to the Dago? Because it had been a transaction in which the Dago had no intention of letting his name appear. Had he been bleeding Sorrell? Had his asking for something, which Raoul Lagarde had reported as being the tenor of their conversation on the night of the murder, been but a further demand for money? Had the Dago been not an unlucky companion in Sorrell's ruin, but the means of it? At least that transaction over the counter of the Westminster Bank explained Sorrell's pennilessness and intended suicide. Then who had sent the £25? Grant refused to believe that the man who had had all Sorrell had, and who had stuck him in the back at not getting more, would have disbursed such a sum for so slight a reason. There was someone else, and the someone else knew the Dago well enough to be in receipt of at least £25 of the amount that the Dago had received from Sorrell. Moreover, the someone else and the dead man had lived together, as witnessed by the dead man's fingerprint on the envelope which had contained the £25. The sentimentality of the action and the lavishness of the amount spoke of a woman.
but the handwriting people had been very sure that the printing was a man's work, and of course that someone else had also owned the gun with which Sorrel had contemplated putting an end to himself. It was a pretty tangle, but at least it was a tangle, closely related and growing closer, so that at any moment he might pick up a lucky thread which, when pulled, would unravel the whole thing. It seemed to him that he had only to find out about the dead man's habits and life generally, and he would have the Dago. Minley Street has, in common with the lesser turnings of Charing Cross Road, that half-secretive, half-disgruntled air that makes it forbidding. A stranger turning into it has an uncomfortable feeling of being unwelcome, as if he had blundered unwittingly into private property. He feels as a newcomer feels in a small café under the half-surprised, half-resentful scrutiny of the habitués. But Grant, if he was not an habitué of Minley Street, was at least no stranger to it. He knew it as most of the yard know the purlieus of Charing Cross Road and Leicester Square. If the outwardly respectable but sly faces of the houses said anything to him, it was, "Oh, here again, are you?" At 32, a painted wooden notice announced that on the first floor were the offices of Albert Sorrel, turf accountant, and Grant turned in at the doorway and climbed the dim stairs, smelling of the charwoman's Monday morning ministrations. The stairs came to a pause at a wide landing, and Grant knocked at the door which had Sorrel's name on it. As he expected, there was no answer. He tried the door and found it locked. He was about to turn away when there was a stealthy sound from inside. Grant knocked again, loudly. In the subsequent pause he could hear the loud hum of the distant traffic and the footsteps of the people below on the street, but no sound came from inside the room. Grant bent to the keyhole. There was no key in it, but the view he obtained was not extensive, the corner of a desk and the top of a coal scuttle. The room he was looking into was the back one of the two which had evidently constituted Sorrel's offices. Grant stayed where he was for a little, motionless and expectant, but nothing living crossed the small, still-life picture that the keyhole framed. He rose to go away, but before he had taken the first step, again there was that stealthy sound. As Grant cocked his head, the better to listen, he became aware that over the banister of the floor above hung an inverted human head, grotesque and horrible, its hair spread round it by the force of gravity into a Struwwelpeter effect. Finding itself observed, the head said mildly, "Are you looking for someone?" "The evidence points that way, doesn't it?" said Grant, nastily. "I'm looking for the man who has these offices." "Oh," said the head, as if this were an entirely new idea. It disappeared and a moment later appeared right way up in its proper place as part of a young man in a dirty painter's smock who came down the last flight to the landing, smelling of turpentine and smoothing down his mop of hair with paint-covered fingers.
"I don't think that man's been here for quite a while now," he said. "I have the two floors above, my rooms and my studio, and I used to pass him on the stairs and hear I don't know what you call them. He was a bookie, you know."
"Clients?" suggested Grant.
"Yes, hear what I presume were his clients, coming sometimes, but I'm sure it's more than a fortnight since I saw or heard him."
"Did he go to the course, do you know?" Grant asked.
"Where's that?"
asked the artist.
"I mean, did he go to the races every day?"
The artist did not know.
"Well, I want to get into his offices. Where can I get a key?"
The artist presumed that Sorrel had the key. The agent for the property had an office off Bedford Square. He could never remember the name of the street or the number, but he could find his way there. He had lost the key of his own room, or he would have offered it for a trial on Sorrel's door.
"And what do you do when you go out?" asked Grant,
curiosity for a moment overcoming his desire to get behind the locked door.
"I just leave it unlocked," said this happy wight. "If anyone finds anything in my rooms worth stealing, they're cleverer than I am."
And then, suddenly, apparently within a yard of them, and just inside the locked door, that stealthy sound, that was hardly sound, merely a head movement. The artist's eyebrows disappeared in the Struwwelpeter hair. He jerked his head at the door and looked interrogatively at the inspector. Without a word, Grant took him by the arm and drew him down the stairs to the first turn. "Look here," he said. "I'm a plainclothes man. You know what that is." For the artist's innocence as to courses had shaken any faith he might have had in his worldly knowledge. The artist said, "Yes, a bobby," and Grant let him away with it. "I want to get into that room. Is there a yard at the back where I can see the window of the room?" There was, and the artist led him to the ground floor and through a dark passage to the back of the house, where they came out into a little bricked yard that might have been part of a village inn. A low outhouse with a lead roof was built against the wall, and directly above it was the window of Sorrel's office. It was open a little at the top, and had an inhabited air. "Give me a leg up," said Grant, and was hoisted onto the roof of the outhouse. As he drew his foot from the painty clasp of his assistant, he said, "I might tell you that you are conniving at a felony. This is housebreaking and entirely illegal."
"It is the happiest moment of my life," the artist said. "I've always wanted to break the law, but a way has never been vouchsafed me. And now to do it in the company of a policeman is joy that I did not anticipate my life would ever provide."
But Grant was not listening to him. His eyes were on the window. Slowly he drew himself up until his head was just below the level of the windowsill. Cautiously he peered over. Nothing moved in the room. A movement behind him startled him. He looked round to see the artist joining him on the roof.
"Have you a weapon?" he whispered. "Or shall I get you a poker or something?"
Grant shook his head, and with a sudden, determined movement flung up the lower half of the window and stepped into the room. Not a sound followed, but his own quick breathing. The wan grey light lay on the thick dust of a deserted office, but the door facing him, which led into the front room, was ajar. With an abrupt three steps he had reached it and thrown it open. And as he did so, out of the second room, with a wail of terror, sprang a large black cat. It cleared the rear room at a bound and was through the open window before the inspector recognized it for what it was. There was an agonized yell from the artist, a clatter and a crash. Grant went to the window, to hear queer, choked moans coming from the yard below. He slid hastily to the edge of the outhouse and beheld his companion in crime sitting on the grimy bricks, holding his evidently painful head, while his body was convulsed in the throes of a still more painful laughter. Reassured, Grant went back to the room for a glance at the drawers of Sorrel's desk. They were all empty, methodically and carefully cleared. The front room had been used as another office, not a living room. Sorrel must have lived elsewhere. Grant closed the window and, sliding down the lead roof, dropped into the yard. The artist was still sobbing, but had got to the length of wiping his eyes. "Are you hurt?" Grant asked.
"Only my ribs," said Struwwelpeter. "The abnormal excitation of the intercostal muscles has nearly broken them."
He struggled to his feet. "Well, that's 20 minutes wasted," said Grant, "but I had to satisfy myself." He followed the hobbling artist through the dark passage again.
"No time is wasted that earns such a wealth of gratitude as I feel for you," said Struwwelpeter. "I was in the depths when you arrived. I can never paint on Monday mornings. There should be no such thing. Monday mornings should be burnt out of the calendar with prussic acid. And you have made a Monday morning actually memorable. It is a great achievement.
Sometimes when you are not too busy breaking the law, come back and I'll paint your portrait. You have a charming head.
A thought occurred to Grant.
I suppose you couldn't draw sorrel from memory.
Struwwelpeter considered.
I think I could, he said. Come up a minute.
He led Grant into the welter of canvas.